Hello, it's Monday, February the 22nd. I'm Andrew Pearce, and this is The Daily Show coming from the Daily Mail newsroom. Are big knickers back in fashion? Apparently, they are. Carrie Simmons, who is the fiancée of Boris Johnson, is at the centre of yet another political row, with one Tory pressure group saying there should be an inquiry into her influence, which they think is malign. The big announcement by Boris Johnson, it's bad news for the hospitality industry. No early opening for pubs or restaurants. But first, it's going to be the big bang. I'm not talking about the city, I'm talking about schools. All schools back on March the 8th. And here's the rub, teachers. You're going to have to wear a mask, we think, in the classroom. Boris Johnson is finally unveiling his roadmap for leading Britain out of lockdown. He's talking about it in the House of Commons this afternoon, and also giving a press conference at Number 10 at 7 p.m. As part of the plan, all schools, the big bang, will reopen on March the 8th. I'm joined now by Jeff Barton, who is, of course, General Secretary of the Association of School and College Leaders. Jeff, we weren't sure if it was going to be a gradual approach, bit by bit, but all the leaks suggest it's all the schools. Now, that's, 10 million odd children. Are you worried that's too big a risk?
I am worried, but I say that as somebody who doesn't know about science, doesn't know about vaccines, doesn't know about epidemiology, but then nor does most of the population, and they listen to different scientists essentially giving us a slightly different version of things. And so I resort to just a common sense view, which is, given that we had so many young people going back into their primary school for one day at the beginning of term, and by the end of the day the Prime Minister was saying they now had to stay at home because of community transmission, I would have just thought that probably lots of parents, let alone those people working in schools, might have thought there would be the kind of phasing of young people coming back that we're seeing in Wales this week, Scotland this week, and Northern Ireland.
There's some suggestion too, I don't know if you've heard that there's going to be a decisive shift in terms of schools. Teachers who have to wear masks in corridors are going to be instructed, or asked at least, to wear them in the classroom. Now, how difficult does that make it for a teacher to communicate with the pupils if they're wearing a mask?
Well, I've heard one stage further than that there'll be an expectation that secondary children will be wearing masks, not just as they were in community areas, but in the classroom.
Yeah.
You can imagine me as a kind of fledgling teacher of French, for example, where communication is all, and I've got a row of perhaps muttering adolescents in front of me, and it makes it much harder for me to know who's saying what. Teaching, as we've seen, is so much reliant on the humanity of young people actually being there to interact with the teacher. That's not to say it's not possible. Other places in the world appear to just expect that young people are wearing masks and teachers are wearing masks, but it will just feel like another impediment, which will make life harder for teachers and teaching assistants, I would think.
How perhaps you can enlighten me on this, how is it now that a year ago or before Christmas, when the government said that schools would reopen in January, how are they going to manage social distancing in classrooms and schools, which will still be required? I mean, they're not going to have the space, are they?
No, they're not. And even if you've got the space in one of the schools, you might not in another, because, you know, the school I led was a Victorian building with narrow corridors and not a lot of space. And similarly, you know, your point actually also could be linked to face coverings. Why is it a year ago we were being told that young people shouldn't have face coverings at all, because actually it was an impediment to good hygiene, because they keep fiddling with them, dropping them, putting them in their pockets and so on. And yet here we are with what looks like it's going to be mandatory. Now, the response might be, well, that's the nature of the virus. But I think the more we can just keep a sense of calm around this, and if it really isn't so high risk about face coverings, can we try to avoid that being in the classroom? Because that's the place where learning is going to happen. And the more we can keep a sense of normality there, I would argue, the better.
What's your hunch about parents? Some parents will be very nervous about sending their children back. If they're required to send their children back to school, Jeff, do you anticipate parents still being fined if they keep their children out of school because they're worried about the pandemic?
I think the government is likely to default to that. So if they're saying that there is an expectation that you as a parent should be sending your child to school unless you've got an agreement that you've withdrawn them for homeschooling, then I think they will use that threat of fines. But of course, the reality is that fines don't come from the government. Fines essentially come via the school through a local authority. And my guess is, at a time of such anxiety, but also a time when we just want to re-establish young people being back in school, that the people I represent, school and college leaders, the last thing they want to get to start doing is saying to the local authority, can you send fines home? And I think we'll have a period of just a kind of professional generosity between the profession of teaching with parents to rebuild the partnership of the young people coming back into our routines in our buildings.
Just finally, Jeff, what about teachers? Are you confident all of them are going to go back? Some of them may have issues. Some of them may feel they can't, they don't feel reassured enough about the safety of school buildings. I mean, what happens then if a teacher says, no, I'm going to carry on teaching from home?
Absolutely. Well, I think that's where there is a big job of work if the government is going to win hearts and minds on this and to give the reassurance. Because, you know, there was an opportunity through the vaccine, which we know isn't the silver bullet, but it would have built some sense that actually you on the front line here, and the same for people working in supermarkets, for example, you on the front line, actually, we're going to, because we're moving so quickly through the vaccine, we're going to build in an opportunity for you. And I think that would have been, even symbolically, a sense of a government which understands the level of anxiety out there and is doing something to alleviate it.
All right, that's Jeff Barton, who's General Secretary of the Association of School and College Leaders. And of course, we'll know more very soon. Well, noticeably absent from the first wave of the reopening will be restaurants and pubs, which may have to remain closed for several months. Last year, the hospitality sector lost an estimated £72 billion in revenue. Just think about the amount of tax that would have cost the Exchequer, and lost more than 1 million jobs. Hospitality chiefs are now calling for more support for their sector. I'm joined now by Kate Nichols, who's the chief executive of UK Hospitality. Kate, I'm just looking, most people seem to think that at best by April, some pubs with an outdoor space will be able to open, but only if they've got an outdoor space. And I'm not sure if that even applies to restaurants with an outdoor space. You talk to government all the time. What's your understanding?
We're the same as you. We are reading the runes of what's come out in the morning papers and waiting to hear the Prime Minister's roadmap at 3:30. Our understanding from that is it's limited outdoor opening for pubs and restaurants in April, but the date to be confirmed in April, whether that's early or middle or late, and then indoor hospitality from middle of May. So a very long time for our businesses to remain, continue to be closed, with very severe restrictions and no revenue coming in.
So where are you financially? Some pubs, as we speak, are doing takeaway business. I don't think, and some restaurants are doing the same, but presumably is barely enabling them to cover their costs.
Absolutely. I mean, I think, you know, that there is a limited amount of delivery and takeaway that's being done by pubs and restaurants. But on average, that's about 15% of normal sales for those that are offering it. So that is not going to cover the costs, nor is it going to be sufficient to offset the loss of the eat-in revenue that they would normally enjoy. You need to have about 10-15% of revenue just to be able to afford to open the doors and employ the staff. But you need to get to 70% of normal revenue levels to break even. And actually, with all the COVID restrictions that we had last year, we were only able to break even for 2 weeks last year. So this is a very precarious situation for many small independent pubs, local community pubs, neighbourhood restaurants, as well as some of the larger businesses who are struggling to stay afloat. It really is a battle for survival, with every day of closure costing £200 million for the sector in lost sales, and as you rightly point out, to the Exchequer from lost tax take. So really, it's a countdown now to the time when we can open, and seeing if we can get as many of the premises that are currently closed through that survival mode and into reopening. But I fear we are likely to lose many tens of thousands of businesses, hundreds of thousands of jobs before we can get to that reopening date, unless we can get additional support from government.
Great British Pub is a great tradition in this country, Kate Nichols. How worried are you that how many more of your members just simply won't be able to reopen their doors if they have to wait until the end of April, May?
We're really concerned at the moment. Just one in five hospitality businesses has enough cash to get through to March, let alone to May, before they can survive. The cash burn for an average pub is about £10,000 a month, for a restaurant £20,000, and government support at the moment is capped at just £3,000 a month. So every day that they are closed means that they are less likely to be able to reopen. It gives them a higher hurdle to overcome. And we know that in October, when we went into our second lockdown, a third of our premises, that's around 30 to 40,000 outlets across the UK, had not reopened their doors after being closed in March. So those are the ones that are most at risk. That's a very high proportion. And there's probably about 1.5 million jobs associated with those businesses that are also at risk if they don't survive.
All right, that's bleak news. But that's from Kate Nichols, who is the Chief Executive of UK Hospitality. If you enjoy The Andrew Pearce Show, why don't you subscribe to us? Leave us a review on Apple Podcasts, Google or Spotify. And you can get in touch by tweeting us at Mail Plus or me at Tory Boy Pearce. The Prime Minister's partner, Carrie Simmons, yet again is at the centre of a political row. Allegations she's pushed people out of jobs, allegations she's proposed people for big jobs. I've written about the very same subject in the Daily Mail today. Now it seems one Tory pressure group, the Bow Group, been around for decades, is calling for an inquiry into whether it is appropriate for a Prime Minister's spouse to have apparently so much influence. Joining me now is Ben Harris-Quinney, who is chairman of the think tank, the Bow Group. Ben, who do you think should conduct the inquiry, knowing, of course, that nobody in Number 10 is going to allow it for a second?
Well, ideally, I think there needs to be an independent inquiry. As you rightly say, it's very unlikely that, unless the government face huge pressure, that they will agree to conducting a government inquiry. And therefore, we think that a judicial review would be appropriate into several key decisions that have been made in recent years and are reported to have been significantly involving Carrie Simmons.
What decisions are you referring to?
I'm referring to the decision to hire Nimco Ali as a government advisor, who is reported to be one of Ms. Simmons' very close friends. I'm talking about the decision to...
She got a job at the Home Office, didn't she? And it wasn't advertised in the usual way.
Yes. So I think, you know, we're not talking about an unpaid position either. So there are taxpayers' funds that are going to this new advisor, and I think there are big questions to answer about what the hiring process was for that and what Ms. Simmons' involvement in it was. And the other questions that I think perhaps more pertinent to the running of the country has been the removal of three key Downing Street officials in Dominic Cummings, Lee Kane, and most recently Oliver Lewis, who I think most people accord a huge amount of the detail work of the Brexit deal to. And I think that there are also questions as to government policy. I mean, we're told a lot about the green agenda that Boris Johnson is going to come forward with and how significant Carrie Simmons has been in that. And of course, the problem with all this is that Carrie Simmons has absolutely no accountability to anyone. And so when these things are going on in Downing Street, when these consistent reports of inappropriate behaviour are coming out, there's no process to deal with Carrie Simmons. You know, even someone that works at Starbucks, if they behave inappropriately at work or, you know, are involved in any inappropriate actions at all, there's a legal process to deal with that. We're talking about the government of the United Kingdom, and there's no legal process to deal with this person, and I think that is a real affront to our democracy.
You would have heard, I'm sure, that Nick Connor, who worked with Carrie Simmons on the Brexit campaign, says she's now effectively become the Downing Street Chief of Staff. The trouble is, he can say that, can't he, Ben? But nobody can prove it. And even if there were to be an inquiry, don't Prime Minister's consort spouses, aren't they always hugely influential? Wasn't Philip May very influential with Theresa May? Wasn't Cherie Blair very influential in the kitchen cabinet of Tony Blair?
Well, I think we're not talking about kitchen cabinet anymore. We're talking about cabinet. We're talking about government. And, I mean, in my lifetime, and I'm not aware of any historical examples of a significant other of the Prime Minister that has been accorded with such a significant role in the running of the country. You know, I don't remember this with Philip May. I don't remember this with Samantha Cameron. I don't remember it with Norma Major, and not even Cherie Blair, who is, of course, an established QC in her own right. So I don't think there's ever been such significant and consistent reporting of the involvement of an unaccountable individual in government. And that is something that has occurred in only a year and a half, whereas many other prime ministers have been in post for a lot longer. So I think for it to have occurred so significantly, so consistently, and in such a short space of time is extraordinary. And I do think that it urgently needs to be looked into. And I would disagree with you that it can never be proven, because, of course, government is a government of records, and it should be a government of transparency. So there should be a record, for example, of the process to hire Nimco Ali as a government advisor. And that's the sort of thing that needs to come, I think, before a judge.
Just finally, not everyone in your own group agrees with what you're doing, of course, Ben. Sir John Redwood, very senior, distinguished Conservative backbencher, was, of course, in the cabinet many years ago. He says this is inappropriate, accused you of sexism.
I'm not aware that John Redwood has accused me of sexism.
Other people have said it's just what you're doing is sexist, but Sir John Redwood has said that this is not what the Bow Group should be doing.
Yeah, well, John Redwood is a patron of the Bow Group, much in the same way as Princess Anne, for example, is a patron of the Scottish Rugby Union. He doesn't have any role in the day-to-day running of the organisation, and I would say it would be very unlikely that you will get a Conservative MP to come out publicly and criticise the role of Carrie Symonds because of the nature of her relationship to the Prime Minister. It sort of can't be perceived as anything other than a personal attack in that sense. However, I've spoken to many Conservative MPs, and there are consistent reports in the press over the last few days of how behind the scenes Conservative MPs are very happy to speak out and raise their concerns about this issue. And I think particularly over the firing of Oliver Lewis, who was very well liked and very well respected on Conservative backbenches, and particularly among the Brexit movement, there is really significant, huge anger and concern among MPs.
All right, that's Ben Harris-Quinney, who is the head of the Bow Group, which is calling for this inquiry into the conduct of Carrie Symonds, who is, of course, the Prime Minister's fiancée and mother of his child. Thanks for joining us. Even though he lost again, that man Jose Mourinho, who even I know is a manager of Tottenham, brackets for now, close brackets, says he's the best manager not just in Britain, the world.
I know. Another, he's very good at these extraordinary press conferences and sound bites. And of course, it's never his fault. It's always somebody else's fault. When things go badly and when the defeats keep coming, that, you know, he refuses to accept any culpability. And his press conferences yesterday was brilliant. So he was asked whether, you know, he was trying to question his own methods. And he said, no, not at all. Zero. Sometimes, the results are a consequence of multi-situations. My coaching methods are second to nobody in the world. So, you know, you'd think, well, it's obviously not his fault, the fact that they've now lost five of their last six Premier League games and slipped down to about 10th, and, you know, the chance of getting in the top four are now looking very remote indeed. And he does this every time. He did this at Manchester United. He's done it at Real Madrid, and it ends in tears. You know, the players do not like to be thrown under the bus, because basically what he's obviously saying is, well, it's not my fault, it's the players' fault. If he's the best coach in the world and his coaching methods are the best, then it's the player's inability to put his coaching methods into practice. And players these days do not like to be thrown under the bus in this way. And it's happened before, and it'll happen again. I'm sure it'll end in tears and a handsome payoff for Jose.
And Liverpool, that team that you used to tell me were impregnable at Anfield, they lost again. Couldn't have lost to a worse team. They're next door neighbours, the Merseyside derby. Everton stuffed them.
They did. They won quite comfortably. It was a fantastic effort by Everton. First time they've won there since 1999. So, you know, as if Carlo Ancelotti, the Everton manager, wasn't popular before the weekend, he's certainly popular now. So, another win for them and another defeat for Liverpool, which is extraordinary that they hadn't lost for however long, you know, at Anfield. And now it's four defeats on the bounce at Anfield. Which
that's extraordinary, isn't it? That's probably the worst for decades, isn't it?
I think it's 98 years. So, you know, it's almost unheard of, you know, to go that many games. I think the last one's 90. Let's have a look. Yeah, 1923, Liverpool have lost four league games in a row at Anfield, tying a club record from 1923. It's incredible. It's incredible the slump they're on. And it's incredible that they just don't seem to find a way out of it. When, as I say, they went so many games unbeaten. Obviously, they were the champions last season. Now, they picked up another injury. Jordan Henderson, their captain, pulled his hamstring. So you have got to have some sympathy with Liverpool and Jurgen Klopp, because they've had so many injuries. Started with Virgil van Dijk going down, actually, in the last Merseyside derby early in the season when he did his knee. And it's been a catalogue of injuries ever since. So I do have some sympathy with them. Meanwhile, for Everton, things are looking rosy.
Very interesting. And finally, who bothered to watch it? Straight sets victory for Djokovic, the ninth win at the Australian Open. So boring. Why did that blooming Greek bloke who knocked out Nadal lose so badly in the semi-finals? He might have at least given him a good run for his money.
He might have done, but I think what that shows is the effects of playing a five-set match in a semi-final, in a quarter-final, as it was, can often have an impact on you for the next game, because it takes a lot out of you, you know, playing those five-set games. And quite often a player who wins one of them comes up short in the next encounter. So you're right, Tsitsipas would have given, the Greek guy, as you call him, would have given, you'd like to think, Djokovic a sterner test than he was given by Medvedev. So it was a disappointment, but it is incredible. You know, it is astonishing. These big three, the Federer, Nadal, Djokovic, when is it going to come to an end? When is this run of those three dominating the majors going to come to an end? We keep thinking, well, surely it's going to happen soon. And Djokovic now 9 Australian Open titles and 18 in total. So Federer 20, Nadal 20, Djokovic 18. And you'd expect now that Djokovic will probably go past the other two. And, you know, he does divide opinion. There's a lot of drama during this tournament about this injury that he was supposed to have had. But he was obviously fine by the end and swinging freely. And number 18 in the bag and number 9 in Australia.
Amazing result. That's Matt Gatwood, yep. Deputy Sports Editor at the Daily Mail. Thanks for joining us. Has the pandemic brought back the era of big pants? In lockdown, it seems, women have decided to quarantine tiny pants and welcome back what are called granny knickers. Not my area of expertise, you understand. Searches for comfy and high-waisted underwear went up a whopping 46% in December. In today's Daily Mail, the TV presenter Beverly Turner tried out some of the best big pants that are out there. Beverly, I've got to say, you look rather good.
Well, thank you, Andrew. Well, it's funny because the female section of the Mail called and said, would you like to do a feature for us about big knickers being popular once again? You can write the copy, but you're also going to have to be photographed in your knickers. And of course, my initial response was, for goodness sake, why couldn't you have asked me last summer when it was sunny and I'd been running every day? You've waited until we got to February when we've all been eating and drinking tons. So I was very careful for 3 days. I had 3 days of not drinking and 3 days of not eating rubbish to get myself in shape for wearing my pants in the paper.
You look pretty good.
Thank you.
But Beverly, do you think women have gone for the comfy look all of a sudden? What's it got to do with lockdown?
Well, you know, I had to ask around all my female friends when I was writing this article, and we were all concluding, the bottom line is, we are finding our tactile pleasure wherever we can at the moment in the last year. And there's no need to be tottering around an office in a little G-string so you don't get VPL, or, you know, the dreaded visible panty line in your tight trousers. So everyone's just wearing comfies at home, and we've gone, you know what? We just want a nice pair of warm, toasty, comfortable pants because we're dressing for ourselves. You know, there are all sorts of, you can see in the paper today, I think I'm styling about 9 pairs of these knickers.
You are.
And they're all sorts of colours and laciness and various fabrics, and they are really quite pretty. I have been a committed G-string or thong wearer for all of my adult life, but More recently, I've gone for the big pants. And you know what? We're walking every day. They keep your bum warm, Andrew.
They do. You know? They do. I'm sure they do. Which were your favourite pair?
Oh, there was a green Marks and Spencer's pair, which I did snaffle in my bag to bring them home. I was actually allowed to keep the knickers. It's a bit like when you try on knickers in a shop. You know, you can't really give them back. You've got to buy them and walk out. You can't try them on. So the stylist was very kind. She said, you can take these, obviously. And there's this green pair, M&S. I've been wearing those, you know, very popular in this house now.
And that's good.
But it's nice to know that M&S still do great knicks, you know. When
I was going to say, because men used to buy their undies at M&S for years, including me, but I haven't bought undies at M&S for donkey's years now.
Me neither, and I did as well, but no, I haven't for years, but there's still some stuff that they're getting right. Next had some beautiful ones. They were all kind of mainly sort of high street, affordable knickers. There's a couple of items in the shoot which were a little bit more expensive, more like £20 a pair of pants, which is kind of, I think that's a bit toppy. But there's lots for everybody. And I've had messages from all sorts of friends today saying, oh, I've gone online and I've bought myself some new knicks. Thanks for the inspiration. So
were there any real shockers that you would expect your grandma might maybe to have worn?
Well, do you know what? We had an all-female crew doing the shoot, which was just lovely, especially when we've been working from home for so long. It was so nice to be back in the studio with real, actual human beings. And so I would come out. We had a massive box of knickers, and the stylist, Amy, would go, try these. And I'd come out, and we'd all go, oh, not sure about those. Or, oh, yeah, I like those, not sure about those. And the ones that we didn't particularly like are the kind of, it's all about the colour. So, like, the creamy flesh colour, you know, kind of peachy. They do look a bit like granny knickers, I hate to say it. They don't have a huge amount of sex appeal. So we've gone in the shoot for lots of brights. There's reds, greens. We even had some yellow, bright yellow sort of summery pants, blue ones, purple ones. So there's loads out there, actually. So I have a whole new load of new knickers in my drawer.
Oh, and him indoors quite likes the green Marks and Spencer's ones, does he?
Well, he did actually, yeah. I mean, he did come along to the shoot, him indoors, my other half. He came along and because we obviously, I'd actually promised him a day together that day because he wasn't working. And then obviously I got a job and I said, just come along, you'll be fine. He popped out, had a little walk around the park and then came back for lunch. And yes, he definitely approved of the green Marks and Spencer's ones. Yeah, they have been a hit.
And how nice are Marks and Spencer's that we can say something nice about them? Because most of the time, ever I talk about M&S, people say, what's happened to Marks and Spencer?
You know, I find the journey of Marks and Spencer quite fascinating. Having been a child dressed in Marks and Spencer's clothes and then gone through kind of teenage years, not going anywhere near it, and now kind of being back in their lingerie department, I do walk through and think they have some massive problems, though, in terms of their fashion. You know, fantastic for a chicken tikka masala ready-made to put in the oven, but really, really bad for any clothes that I would want to wear kind of at my age. I do think they've got a problem with their fashion, and that's kind of been borne out by sales figures, hasn't it, over the years?
Absolutely. Yeah. But they haven't got a problem with their big green knickers.
No, their big green knickers are fabulous. But, you know, I'm sort of longing for the days when we can get back into shops and walk around and browse and, you know, not just have to click and buy things online. We're all desperate, aren't we?
We know the Prime Minister's showing us a bit of ankle today, Beverly, but not much, I'm afraid. No, the shops aren't opening anytime soon, sadly.
No, but anyway,
we are grateful for the thrills where we can get them. And it was great fun reading about you today, Beverly. Looking fabulous, I've got to say, in a variety of big knickers in the Daily Mail. Beverly Turner. That's all we've got time for today. From the latest from the Daily Mail, download the Mail Plus app every weekday at 5 p.m. You can listen to me all over again. I'm Andrew Pearce. This is The Andrew Pearce Show. I'll be back tomorrow. Have yourselves a great evening and good night.